that made me.
The year that made me.
The year that made me.
The year that made me. Well, this week's guest fell into journalism. It was a case of mistaken identity for a job interview, but he went with it. Almost 40 years later, he can look back on a career in which he's been witness to many of the events that have shaken and shaped the world and transfixed us television viewers at home. He's reported from more than 40 countries on every continent, with the exception of Antarctica, I think, I'm told anyway. It's chronicled in his new book, Minefields, A Life in the News Game. Hugh Rimmington, good morning. Welcome to Sunday Extra.
Morning.
So you were... You had this incredible early childhood, born in Sri Lanka, moved to England, then to New Zealand. Take us back to Christchurch, New Zealand. It's the late 1970s. You're in your final years of high school. What was the ambition at that point?
None at all. I was actually a bit of a messed up kid in my teens. I was a heavy drinking, slightly depressed teenager, and I was grogging on before going to school in the morning. The teachers had certainly noticed, and my marks were not going anywhere fast. So I left school and got a job as a hospital cleaner. And I was one of those polishing machines. I used to go over the floors at the teaching hospital. And I was even a failed hospital cleaner because I was finishing up one night and my machine suddenly stopped. And I thought, oh, well, you know. So I wrapped it up, came back in the next day, and they said, any problem last night? No, I said blankly. I'd managed to short out the blood supply, the blood bank, to the entire city because the cord had gone underneath these big fridges and they were putting out they were cancelling operations. They couldn't sack me because it was a unionised force. So I got moved on to the lowest job imaginable in this hospital system, which was cleaning the rat cages in the animal laboratory where they did hideous experiments on animals.
Delightful.
I was a rat poo cleaner. And somehow or other, I came into the orbit of a radio news director who mistook who I was. I was nothing to him. But he thought I'd gone to him to apply for a job. So he starts interviewing me for a journalism job, which I had never, it never occurred to me of a journalist. But I'm cleaning rat cages, right? So so I went with it and sort of was a bit cheeky, and he hired me.
And so that first gig was at Radio Avon. Mm. What was that? What did that involve?
Well, it's amazing actually because it shows you how much journalism has changed. Because Radio Avon was a profitable little radio station in Christchurch, New Zealand. It had 13 journalists, all of whom I must say smoked, 13 journalists to cover a town of 300,000 people. We covered council committee meetings. We ran 18 hours of news bulletins a day. I mean, a similar radio station today would have 0 to maybe 3 journalists. So it was possible to get into the game. And so I started to learn my craft from some pretty good hands.
And so you then eventually ended up in Perth and Melbourne, a few eventful years there. And then you had your first foreign assignment in Fiji covering a coup in 1987. Yeah. Talk us through that. What did that teach you about the gig that was to come?
It was interesting because I got to go to Fiji for no other qualification other than the fact I lived not far from the radio station and I could get home to get a passport to get to the airport. No one else in the newsroom could. More senior people couldn't. And so that was one stroke of luck. So I was on the plane to Fiji. The next stroke of luck was that a coup, this was a coup that had taken place, the Rambuka coup in 1987. And the Melbourne flight got in, but the Sydney flights were sent back. And so there were no Sydney journos able to get in. So, and TV couldn't get pictures out because there was no TV feeding system in Fiji at that time. So it became a radio story. So there I was, 26 years old or something, basically by default owning this story of a shocking event at the time, of a military coup in what seemed to everyone a bucolic, beautiful island group in the Pacific. And it wasn't that easy going. You know, people called it the holiday coup and so on. But, you know, there were troops in the streets. There were mobs in the streets. There were Peter Cave and Red Harrison, the ABC and the BBC correspondents were marched out in the dead of night and twice put in front of firing squads. And it was only because the soldiers argued over whether there were witnesses or whether there were whether they had the appropriate orders. You know, they thought they were going to get shot. It wasn't so easy. I got thrown in jail. Briefly, I was sort of arrested in the middle of the night, but it gave me a sense of that you know, this almost out of body experience you have when you're reporting something which is enormously big. You're trying to get an idea of a complex place. And for the first time also, they flew in a few international correspondents to cover it. And this little light bulb went off in my head and thought, wow, this might not be just one random peak experience in your life. There are people who do this for a living. And it gave me a chance to see and reflect on what it might be like to go from calamity to calamity.
As you mentioned, the profession of journalism has changed. These tiny towns with very big radio newsroom staff, things are very different today. But the world also has changed a lot. Do you think the role of the foreign correspondent has changed as well? Is it still a valuable contribution in this sort of post-truth fake news era?
No, I think more valuable than ever, potentially. But the fact of it is that the money's gone from it. So the most profound, one of the most profound things that's happening to society, not just journalism, is that for 200 years, advertising and journalism, news, has been bonded together. If you wanted to advertise, you went to TV stations, print houses, radio stations, and advertising is a big part of the economy. Therefore, journalism was well-funded. Advertising has gone elsewhere. And so it's not the fault of newsrooms, news organizations. They can't afford to do what they previously were able to do. The reality is that journalism's domestically or foreign correspondent bureaus no longer have the money, unless, you know, they're publicly funded is probably the last best hope of the side. Now, that has a profound effect on our capacity to have experienced hands looking independently at things that are going to have an influence over the world and our lives. This is a big, profound change, and we haven't yet measured the social impacts of it.
But there's also this trust deficit. People don't trust you, they don't trust me the way that they might have trusted journalists in the past.
Oh, well, I don't think we're ever that much loved. I wouldn't put the rose-tinted glasses on too much. But I think,
you
know, it's a useful
function. You get it every day on social media, people talking about you being part of the mainstream media. And,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
There is a real dislike of the media.
Well,
today,
there always was. Let's not pretend otherwise. People have always rated journalists very low on the scale, and that's fine. But I do think that there's also been a valuable thing that they have that journalists have contributed. And I think in days gone by, journalists were more likely to be centrist, whereas now people are looking to find places in the market and they can go anywhere for it. It's, you know, essentially in ancient times, in the village was a mob and everyone spoke with one voice. It eventually come, you know, and shouted each other down. And often the louder voices are the ones who are most angry or whatever. And then the media came along and mediated those, you know, crude emotions, etc. And power would talk to the public and the public would talk to power through the media. The media's more or less disappeared. We're back into voices in the mob, but it's a much larger mob. It's a global mob. And this is the environment that we're in. And of course, journalists are, you know, people just can say how much they dislike journalists or politicians or sports stars. Doesn't matter.
The year that made you. Why was 1992 significant?
Well, I was a very raw reporter. Hamish, some listeners may be aware, is a very young and talented young man. I was at the time a young man, but significantly less talented. And I turned up very raw in London as the Nine correspondent. I'd been in TV for 3 years. It was a remarkable act of faith to send me to such a key job, and that was 1992. And I arrived literally within a day of arriving. I heard for the first time Nirvana. Now, I heard a lot of music in that year, 1992, including a lot of opera because I was interested in that, and I started paying. I thought, wherever you are, pay for whatever the locals do, and they do opera. So I saw, we could be listening to opera. I'm about to blast everyone's eardrums with a bit of Nirvana. But, you know, I'm a post-punk kid. It was good power pop. I loved it. It stood the test of time. So it was a momentous year as I started to become a foreign correspondent and travel the world.
It's very rare that we play Nirvana on RN, let alone...
There are probably good reasons for that.
At 9:30 on a Sunday morning, but here it is. Smells Like Teen Spirit. That is Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. If you don't like it, you can blame Hugh Remington. Hugh, thank you very much indeed. Fantastic. 1992, the year that made you. And what a song.
Great song. Wake up, everybody. Smell the coffee.
The book is called Minefields, A Life in the News Game. The journalist is Hugh Remington.